Beyond the headlines. This is World Insight.
Hello, I'm Tian Wei, and welcome to World Insight. The 18th Beijing International Automotive Exhibition rolls out this week. The event has so far drawn nearly 500 participants, both from within and beyond China's borders, covering traditional and emerging enterprises. Held for the very first time since the pandemic, Auto China 2024 offers the world an important window into both China's and the world's tech advances, especially the four-wheel kind. For the latest discussion on the new energy vehicles, we are joined by this panel. For more on the discussions related to China's auto industry, we are joined in Mumbai by Ravi Bhatia, who is the president and director of the Jato Dynamics. In Beijing, Xing Lei, former chief editor of China Auto Review and co-host of China EVs and More. Welcome to both of you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
These are the busy days for you guys because of the Beijing Auto Show and all the global discussions related to the auto industry. I want to start about the important topic of China's EVs. Mr. Xing, the market penetration, according to the earlier plan, is likely to be 40% by the end of this year, but it's very much likely that goal will be achieved much earlier, at least according to some of the top auto company managers. So tell me more about where is China in terms of EVs?
The couple of days before I arrived, one of the organizations published data in the first half of April, first 2 weeks, the retail sales penetration of NEVs went above 50% for the first time ever.
And 50.3% already, right?
50.3%. So that gives you an idea of where the market is right now versus the kind of expectations that the tipping point has long passed and we're entering into another period. I wouldn't say the growth that we've seen the last few years, but the fact of the matter is that people, when they make a purchase, either trade-ins, policies currently in place to drive trade-in, more than likely you are going to buy an NEV because of the selection, variety, at the different price points is just nowhere else in the world.
More about the competition. I'm sure we have a lot of stories to tell about that. To you, Mr. Bhatia, your understanding of where China is in terms of new energy vehicle or PHEVs as well.
Yeah, so I think both new energy vehicles and PHEVs are important component of how we go into the future, which is more greener and less polluting. And China is clearly the place to be for the dynamism that is happening in the market. So as we just heard that 50.4% is what was crossed very recently. This is a benchmark anywhere in the world. We have not seen this kind of new energy vehicle adoption rate. So there are a couple of things happening, I think, in China. One, we see the innovation rate has gone super fast. So we are beginning to see products getting launched in succession, which are trying to outdo each other. So the level of innovation in not only the powertrain side of the vehicle, but other conveniences also accelerating very much.
Mm-hmm.
So customers are, I think, spoiled for the choice. And the whole world is looking at the innovations happening in China, including India. Mm-hmm. While everybody has sustainability goals, everybody is talking about getting there very quickly, but China has shown a model which others really aspire to come close to. India really is at a very low level of penetration. We just about crossed 2.1%. So you can see the difference between 50.3% and 2.1%.
Earlier, we see the American EV maker Tesla cut its rates on some of the models sold in China. Later, we see Li Auto immediately follow up. And we also saw not only the traditionally successful, such as BYD in China, but also some of the others, such as Huawei and also Xiaomi, catching up into the auto industry, especially EVs. So what is the reality of competition here in the China market, Mr. Xing?
Well, the reality, one word that I often use to describe the kind of competition is bloodbath, the price deterioration of what you would expect a model to be priced at a certain feature and price point. So that has been coming down dramatically ever since Tesla cut prices in January of 2023. So this price war has been going on for almost 1.5 years. And Mr. Bhatia mentioned something about innovation. I could give you actually a metric of how fast innovation in China. And that metric is the expectation of a generational change, a model generation change is 3 years. A refresh is 1 year. An OTA update monthly. Basically, over-the-air updates, you know, like what you have on your phone.
Yeah.
And that has been happening, at least for you know, Tesla is really the one who started it. But all the China EV makers, right? OTA, they're weekly updates, if not daily. But it's at least monthly.
What about the competition that you see, Mr. Bhatia?
Yeah, so I see that the value pricing equation has gone totally in favor of the customer. There are too many players jostling for position. Clear leaders are yet to emerge in China. You know, normally the automotive industry always talks about the top 10 or top 12 players. But here, there are many more players jostling for position. So they are kind of outdoing each other, not only in terms of pricing, but also the value that they are offering. So the customers in China are really in for a good time. They are being spoiled for choice and at an amazing price.
And it's a sales competition, isn't it, Mr. Xing? You see, you know, the heads of the China automakers, they all have to become, to a certain extent, internet influencers, starting their own Chinese version TikTok, studio in a way, in order to attract all the eyeballs. And the sales competition is fierce here.
I mean, the competition, we can talk about different kind of competition. And you mentioned these CEOs going up onto, you know, live stream and talking about their products themselves, right? Yeah. Lei Jun, the example. And the latest number I've just heard, Xiaomi plans to deliver 100,000 units this year, 3 years after they decided to enter the auto industry. And only a month after they launched this first model. It's, right, to the foreign... the other competitors established, it's unfathomable.
You know, the traditionally very strong ones, such as BYD, and the very much technology related, such as Huawei, and some of the earlier budding automakers, especially on EVs in China, how do you see they are trying to get their share of the uniqueness in the market? Mr. Xing, very briefly.
Price, affordability, feature, iteration speed, faster market, manufacturing. Everything is moving at fast.
Mm. You know?
All at the same time.
Mr. Bhatia, we understand the other way around, because if you look at the German automakers, since your organization is one headquartered in Europe, they are saying, you know, we are not necessarily say we want to use trade against trade rules against innovation, but rather we want to cooperate with Chinese automakers for the EV market and also for the EV technologies, not only in China, but also in the European market. So how do you see this competition, cooperation kind of thing having spillover effect worldwide?
Yeah, I think what you're bringing up is very interesting. You know, I believe the industry has moved away from it, but country of origin is still very important. So when I talk about country of origin, we always talk about German cars, American cars, or Japanese cars. And now we talk in a very different way about Chinese cars as well. So while there is a pressure on international brands in China, which used to enjoy a very, very predominant position, but we are beginning to see Chinese manufacturers assert in the home market, but with the capacity that they have created, they have an ability to serve a very large proportion of new energy vehicles worldwide. We are already beginning to see this in many countries in Europe where there is distribution being set up. So JETO is working very closely with Chinese manufacturers, trying to help them map the market, trying to help them take a structure of the market so that they can understand what offerings will work in those markets. Because buyers tend to be different in every market. What works in one market may not automatically translate into a success in another market. So that's where our ability to you know, map the market with factual information is being very helpful to a lot of Chinese companies.
I see. Mr. Xing, earlier I talked to the global chairman of Mercedes-Benz. He was talking about investing more in China.
The Chinese economy stabilizing and growing, and also that it's open for foreign investment. Mercedes-Benz has been investing here for more than 20 years, and we continue to do so. We are preparing for launches of our next generation electric vehicles in China, and with our joint venture partner here in Beijing, we're putting significant investment into our operations. China is the biggest car market in the world, and it's the biggest market for Mercedes. And we are a company that, of course, we do business here. Most of our operations are here. So we build almost all the vehicles that we sell in China, in China. But we're also, together with other partners, an exporter back from China to Europe. So I think the message is we need to keep trade relations open and vibrant, focus on win-win in terms of economic growth, and cooperate to further develop technologies, innovation, and also keep on working on the CO2 reduction.
So how do you see the diversity, you know, of cooperation and competition, once again, between Chinese automakers and international ones as well, both for China market and elsewhere?
A blank line and another blank line. The first blank line on the bottom is a foreign automaker. The second bottom line, the line on the bottom, is a Chinese tech company. So going forward, you're going to see more of those foreign established automakers working specifically in China, for China, with the Chinese tech companies. One is to fit into the local ecosystem. Two is to address the local customer needs. And three, just basically being faster. You have to work with the local players. I think that's the formula for success for any foreign automaker. And you're going to see more announcements.
So, Mr. Bhatia, now, there were earlier suggestions by American administration officials, frequent use of so-called overcapacity. This time also referred to the electronic vehicles, new energy vehicles in China. Now, how do you see, really, as we discussed earlier, one is the China market, the other is Chinese and international automakers cooperate both for Chinese market and for the international market. Of course, the Chinese automakers are also going international as well. For example, establishing their manufacturing centers elsewhere and also exporting their products overseas. So how do you see these very interesting combination and the so-called rhetorics of overcapacity these days you heard a lot in the media stories?
I think there are three aspects of the story that we need to look at. One aspect is the consumer's aspect, right? So to a consumer, a good value offering is always attractive. Consumer wants to get the best value for his money. And if the product is satisfying the minimum needs of quality, he will be all right. The second aspect is the supply chain collaboration. So now we are beginning to see a position for China where there is a very important part of supply chain. So in supply chain, there are technology aggregates which move from one part of the world to the other part of the world. So you are beginning to see more and more Chinese components inside the vehicles, which may not be labeled as Chinese vehicles. Now, the third is the full vehicle exports. Now, it's the full vehicle exports which are raising the flag everywhere. So then the issue of supply overcapacity comes in, the issue of barriers come in. Because OEMs, the countries are trying to protect the domestic OEMs. They are trying to protect their jobs. So these are emotive issues in all the countries. So when you talk about jobs, when you talk about, you know, capacity and protecting local manufacturing, it's always always an emotive issue. But I think from supply chain issue, the share of Chinese components in global cars is already very high.
So the overcapacity issue, the caveat is what happens when the NEV take rate goes to, you know, possibly 75%. Some have forecasted by 2030 in China. What happens with the ICE, which is the internal combustion engine vehicle, that'll be down to 25%. Now there's tens of millions of capacity on that end of the game. What happens? What happens to the jobs? What happens to those capacity? I think that's That's the thing to watch.
So you are saying the overcapacity is not necessarily about the spillover of competition internationally for EVs, but rather what happened to the traditional automakers, the overcapacity of theirs?
The simple answer is yes.
Mr. Bhatia, we also know that these traditional automakers, they will be either kicked out of the market because they are not changing, or they're very much in line now already, also switching to new technologies and also to NEVs and PHEVs as well.
Yeah, there is a lot of pressure on traditional automakers to respond to the new energy vehicle race, which is happening right now. The question is, in every country, the situation on ecosystem readiness is not similar. While China has a very strong ecosystem, which facilitates the use of new energy vehicles, other countries are still catching up. So if I was to do a readiness index of all the countries, they don't rank similarly. So there are two things which have to happen. The NEV products have to arrive, the ecosystem has to be ready, and the customer have to transition. All these three things falling in place will make the world a more greener, more better place.
For new energy vehicles and also HPEVs, what it could mean, how much an opportunity do we know that is there to exist for innovation and therefore for scaling up of the latest manufacturing as well?
One is simplifying the manufacturing process. And you're seeing this happening, you know, from Tesla, from the Chinese EV companies. Battery innovation, whether it's chemical or structural innovation, is happening fast. Autonomous driving. So in China, it's NOA, which is the navigate on autopilot. If you don't have that feature, what the customer expected, you're not going to sell. So that's one huge racetrack. And fourth, how you interact with the vehicle through voice recognition, through different UI and UX, outside and inside the vehicle, is all of these things are very important, is happening at a fast pace.
Thank you so much, Mr. Bhatia, Mr. Xing. Still to come, the use of space, building and light to bring comfort and joy to developing communities. That's the work of architect Diabedo Francis Kelly, the Pritzker Award honoree.
Beyond the headlines, this is World Insight.
Welcome back. I'm Tian Wei. The Pritzker Award, the world's most prestigious award, is given to the most talented architects every year. Diabedo Francis Kelly is a talented architect that has won the award. He was born and raised in Western Africa. He is known for the architecture that empowers and also transforms communities, especially contemporary schools, health facilities, civic buildings, and public spaces in infrastructure-hungry developing countries. It was just amazing how you managed to build so many things, schools, health facilities, museums, you know, parliamentary buildings, and also, you know, for the outdoor festivals, everything. How did you manage to do that? Where does all these inspiration come from?
It's a passion and a love for design. It's the passion and the love to create space that will inspire people, that will give people chance to celebrate themselves, to stay in intimacy, to be with their friends, to be with their family. It is this love, like the, you know, that is pushing me to create what I'm doing.
I totally believe in that, because without that, there's no real drive. But, you know, you've been building so many things, including, you know, very low budget school for developing countries, particularly in your home country and home continent, Africa. So what is the architecture with the lowest budget you ever built?
No, it is my very first school, the school that I built in my home village. There was, let me say, honestly, there was no budget, you know?
I thought you were going to say $1,000 or $2,000, but there's zero that budget.
And then, but I had to create a foundation to find people that will donate me the little money that I needed to buy the material. you know, all the work came from the community. You know, I had to convince everyone to support build the school. And that it happened. And is so making my people today very proud, you know, very proud.
I saw the photo of that school, very unique. And it builds beautifully with, you know, the surroundings and the lighting of the day.
and also the colors being combined, as well as the local materials. Tell me more about how you came up with that idea. How did it work eventually?
We have to say that it's very hot. So in my home country, really, it can be very hot. And at the same time, people are really curious, enthusiastic for new things. And that is another aspect that is important to highlight. People being using clay, like to build their houses for generations. But you know, nowadays people consider clay to be poor people material. So first of all, I needed to improve the quality of clay, just putting a little bit of cement and making bricks that look so regular through compression, you know.
You built after the school, which is your first building, you said. You also built so many other things, like we said earlier, you know, hospitals, parliamentary buildings, and you're building around the world now. But you said famously one thing, which I think really need to be noted in this interview. You said, it's not because you are rich that you should waste materials. It is not because you are poor that you should not try to create quality. I love that.
This is a fact. Innovation and industry is great. Industrialization is great for our future. But it's also, we have to know that they brought things that are causing a big burden. I'm thinking about plastic and certain other materials that now has become part of our concern. I think the future of architecture will be how we combine all these elements with natural resources to create space for people. Building will still be needed tomorrow, but that is how we balance all of these together.
Because you yourself, I mean, you grew up on the African continent in Burkina Faso, right? If I remember right.
Yes.
And also you yourself experienced the days when you don't have enough lighting, when you are in a very poorly furnitured or built classroom, when you were a student there. So you know exactly what the student wanted and how to achieve it. You put your heart in it, it seems.
Exactly, exactly. In my, you know, when I was a kid, I had to leave my family when I was 7 to go to a city 20 kilometers far to attend education, but 20 kilometers doesn't sound like far. But imagine there is even no, at that time, no bike. The only one holding bicycle, you could count them. There was only few people in my village owning bicycle. So if you think about transportation and you see that the only means of transportation is a bicycle owned by a few people, and then there is a donkey, then you understand how far 20 kilometer may be, you know. And so I went there to attend school, and then it revolted me to see that you outside there was a sunlight so bright, but inside you could barely read because there was no light, you know. There was like tiny little openings, and also it was hot inside. And in my head, let me say, I was growing the idea to make things better one day when I become adult. You know, that is very simple. And so to create better classrooms for kids and even more to do better architecture. That is how it started. And so, but if I'm like taking my time to really be myself, I will tell you doing the projects always for me is like, wow, I want to fascinate people. I want to inspire people through my architecture. I want to take elements from my culture to bring it to places where I think it is needed to show the abundance of fantasy, you know, and imagination from my culture. Like if I do a project in the US, I will do everything so that people know this continent has more to deliver than misery. Mm-hmm. And that is what I'm trying to bring. And then also I'm trying to be careful with material, you know? I think everywhere in the world we need quality as a site. And that I'm trying to really think about elements like the environment also, because it is a big concern. And that's what I'm trying to also introduce into my architecture.
And that's all the time we have for today. I'm Tian Wei. On behalf of my team, thanks for being with us. Bye for now.